Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be living in the UK and on the edge of sanity. I'm Rich McCarthy, ex-teacher, ex-energy auditor, and real-life dad and house husband.
I'm Gola Boom. I'm European, I'm German, I'm a wife and I'm a mother, an academic, and also living here on the edge of sanity.
That's right. It's not funny the second time round, though.
Right, okay. Well, that's me, a German, stealing all the jokes that she can get.
And today we're looking at the Labour Party's Green New Deal.
And in the last two episodes, of course, we looked at the Green Party's Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to look at Labour's promise.
And it was difficult because they make it kind of hard for us. We looked at the manifesto, but the manifesto was split into several sections on the Green New Deal, I think.
Yes, and I think we should actually premise this that there were two key documents that we were looking at, but we're going to choose only one to focus on. Mm-hmm. And then there are more documents that are relevant for that. You know, we are going to put it into the show notes so you can link on that. But just to outline why it was difficult. So the Labour Party has a Green New Deal vision with its own website, and that focuses on the justifications for political, social and environmental change. So it's highly detailed. It's very evidence-based. It has rich links. You know, it's a fabulous document.
Good read.
Really good read. Really, really long. Really, really detailed. But it doesn't propose so many solutions. So it's rather a justification and a status quo of where we are. Why do we need to move into a green
economy? To convince people that it's important to do.
Yeah, the evidence base is really, really good. But then in terms of last year's general election, what went into the manifesto is a policy document which is called the Green Industrial Revolution.
And they had a bunch of things from it in that, which was based on a report that they sort of outsourced called 30 for 2030, which is 30 recommendations to reduce emissions by 2030.
Yeah, and we'll put that link also in the show notes. The 30 by 2030 report was commissioned by the Labour Party, and it was experts writing it, briefing the Labour Party about solutions. So that's a solution-focused kind of document. In itself, it's like 140 pages, 120 pages.
177. I remember them, some numbers.
And we should also say there's a fourth document that we considered, but we'll put the links in the show notes, but we're not focusing on, because, of course, we're half year on and the whole world has changed. So, of course, as part of their Green New Deal vision, they have a whole section on the website about a green recovery in the post-pandemic world. And much of that feeds from the Green Industrial Revolution, the manifesto. So, of course, from the policies, because, of course, as we said before, in order to recover from lockdown into a green economy, you can use Green New Deals to shift from a sort of post-pandemic crisis into a new green economy.
But that isn't a new document. It's lots of documents again. Like the Green New Deal document isn't a document. It's about 9, 12
Different PDFs, yeah. But
different PDFs.
I'm sure you can put them all together.
Well, yes, but they're not all together as one document, and then we could call it a document. So just so that people don't get confused, that's like 9 documents. This is another 9 documents.
We should emphasise, you know, that the key ones is that vision document, the Green New Deal for Labour. But actually the most key one where the promises are specified is, of course, what went into the manifesto, which is the Green Industrial Revolution. And there's one big difference between those two. The Green New Deal, the vision document, asks for or advocates for a zero carbon emission target by 2030, whereas the manifesto advocates or puts in policies for a net zero, towards net zero.
Net zero.
But the difference is net zero
in
or zero
30s.
Carbon emission. And I think that's a major shift. And I know that we had yesterday morning, we had a whole discussion, hour long discussion about the merits of moving towards net zero rather than zero.
Zero emissions is virtually impossible because of various things like if you make cement, that industrial process releases carbon dioxide. If you are farming and you till the soil and turn over the topsoil, that releases carbon dioxide into the environment, into the atmosphere. So inherently, by just trying to exist, we're going to be releasing carbon dioxide. So we have to, that's why the idea of net zero came in, where we do other things, which if we've planted trees, those will absorb, those will sequester carbon dioxide. They will absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and grow new branches, which are full of carbon. So that's kind of sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere very slowly. That's why net zero emissions came about.
Yeah, and I think the argument against is that you can offset internationally, which paves the way for international exploitation. Can I read something now from the Green Vision document, the Green New Deal? Because I think they explain it quite clearly. They say, why zero carbon? And again, as we said, they moved in the manifesto, they actually moved away from zero carbon, they moved to net zero carbon. But why zero carbon? And it says, though such a distinction may seem minimal between zero and net zero emissions, the difference between the two can be substantial, with net often used as a catch-all for controversial emissions offsetting and unproven carbon removal technologies, allowing nations to continue with business as usual. Labour for a Green New Deal advocates a transition to a zero carbon economy through the complete elimination of the use of fossil fuels. And of course, that sort of business as usual paves the way for, again, you know, as we said, sort of exploitation, social injustice. And when we discussed it yesterday morning, you know, I sort of came to the conclusion that what I would like, you know, realizing and admitting that zero carbon by 2030 is an impossibility, but we need to have a sort of ethical net zero carbon target.
Well, I think any kind of offsetting that you do has to be done within your country, personally.
Yeah,
and that way
that might solve that.
You know, you're not relying on the people in Brazil or Papua New Guinea or somewhere like that, some country that we regard as being poor, to stop developing or to go backwards in their development or something like that, just to allow us to play around with our energy use.
Let's go into the Green Industrial Revolution, that document, and it's separated into four parts. One part is the economy and energy. The second part is transport. Then the third one is environment. And the fourth one is animal welfare. And again, you know, just like with the other Green New Deal, when we looked at that, you know, we probably can't cover it all in one podcast. So we might actually go into two episodes. So we would cover economy and energy as well as transport today, and then environment and animal welfare.
Mm-hmm.
But I had some difficulties with that type of category, because environment here is separate to economy and energy. But, you know, that maybe sets it apart from the Green Party's Green New Deal. This is called a Green Industrial Revolution. And because it's labor, there needs to be industry in the mix, conceptualized as a substantial element of the solution.
Yeah. Although I didn't get the feeling there was.
So let's go into the first section, which is economy and energy.
And economy and energy were split into several sections itself.
So you mean the sections like investment,
yep,
leveling up,
mm-hmm,
energy, ownership, industry and innovation, skills.
So in terms of investment, they said that there would be a sustainable investment board made up of the Chancellor, the Business Secretary, the Bank of England Governor, trade unions and businesses.
And I think, you know, that's not a bad idea to oversee, no, you know, and coordinate that type of investment which pushes forward, yeah, you know, our green economy.
Absolutely, yeah. And they'd have an office for budget responsibility. Oh, that they'd ask the Office for Budget Responsibility also to take on board climate and environmental impacts of fiscal decisions.
The climate and environmental impact needs to be incorporated in its forecasts.
Yeah, which is, actually, Wales has a bill effectively doing this that, I can't remember what it's called, Wellbeing of Future Generations Act from 2015.
Right. Okay.
I think we should go for that. Seems like a good thing to do.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly that every single decision making should incorporate the environmental,
the well-being of future generations. Yeah,
yeah.
And largely that will focus on climate emissions and whether that's going to be there for, you know, is it really a good idea to build HS2 when it's going to emit so much carbon dioxide? And
yeah, or even worse, is it really worthwhile expanding various airports?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And they do put a number on a national transformation fund of 400 billion. I didn't quite understand it. So,
yeah, 400 billion over 10 years, which seems perfectly all right.
So the purpose of that is to rewrite the Treasury's investment rules to guarantee that every penny spent is compatible with our climate and environmental targets. So this is a direct quote from their document. But, you know, it seems a lot of money to just rewrite the Treasurer's investment rules.
Yes, although 250 billion they earmark for the Green Transformation Fund, which is good to be a national investment bank with regional development banks. So right. Nine regional development banks in nine in England, is that right? And then one for Wales, one for Scotland, one for Northern Ireland. So they'd have the 250 billion between them, and they would be lending that out to local businesses, local businesses, and they're mandated to lend in line with decarbonizing the economy, increasing productivity and creating good jobs.
So did you understand, because I think, you know, having a national investment bank is not a bad thing. We have that also on a European level, you know, when we went through Ursula von der Leyen's, you know, sort of vision document, it also mentioned similar things on a larger scale. You know, this is on a European scale.
And the
Greens
had a similar thing as well.
Exactly. This is on a British scale. But what exactly, now, you know, this might be me not understanding the British economic system. What they also proposed a new post bank based on post office branches. What is the difference between the National Investment Bank with regional development banks and a post bank branch system?
I haven't got a clue. The post bank thing sounds like a good idea, except where would you go in a post office to talk about getting a loan? Our local post office wouldn't have a place for us to go and talk about that. And I think a lot of local post offices wouldn't have a place to go and talk in a little back room with the post office bank manager. Maybe it would all be done online or something.
But I assume the strength of using the post office branches for banking services is that we have a branch in almost every town and every city.
Yeah, I think
but,
so. That's
you know,
the
again,
idea.
You know, that's why I'm thinking, you know, certainly from the document that we read, the connectivity between the regional development banks and the post office, post bank branches didn't come out very clear. You know, is there two different purposes? One is to provide lending for enterprise infrastructure and innovation, as it says. Mm-hmm. The other one, the post office branches enabling thousands of bottom-up transformation changes by startups, small businesses, local cooperatives. But isn't there a big overlap between, you know, SMEs innovating?
Well, I'm presuming that the national investment banks are supposed to be doing it for big things, regional things. You know, they're thinking regionally like roads, except that roads wouldn't be a good idea, would it?
Yeah.
So maybe rail systems and things like that, rather than a small company to do whatever.
Okay. So,
and I'm also wondering whether that's where some of the other 150 billion is supposed to go. Because, as you said, they started off saying it was 400 billion altogether. 250 billion goes to the Green Transformation Fund. And then we don't know what happens to the other 150 billion. Mm-hmm. But perhaps some of that goes to the post bank, post office.
Hmm. But as a last element of this section, it mentions also that the criteria will be changed for companies. In order to be listed on the London Stock Exchange, they need to address how they contribute to tackling the climate environmental emergency.
Yeah, which is a good idea, but they don't say how that's going to happen. Because for me, people like Shell and BP, they already have things, you know, they have glossy brochures about how they're saving the world by doing this, that and the other. Except we're not going to tell you about the millions of barrels of oil we're pumping out of the ground every day. So they're addressing things, but they're not, you know, their key reason for being in existence is a terrible one.
Yeah. Right. So the second section of this section, you know, we're in subsections here, is leveling up. Now, you mentioned to me earlier on that you don't like the word leveling up.
Yeah, I think leveling up sounds terrible because it's promising, in a way, it's promising better for everybody. It's like saying, we're all going to go up to this great level. Whereas I think a huge number of people in Britain need to go down in terms of our energy use, in terms of our transport, in terms of our things. we need to get used to the idea of having less but sharing more, which means that you can do as much but own less.
Right.
I think is what we need to be doing. So this leveling up seems to promise, oh, we can all have it really good, like those people who've got it good at the moment. But those good people who've got it good at the moment are cheating everybody else of their futures, it seems. And if we all do that, you know, we can't possibly all do that. So that's why I'm against leveling up as a title. But then you quite liked it.
I think I like the concept. And I think, you know, I'm somebody who would have chosen the heading decentralization.
Yes.
But maybe
decentralization is much better, I think.
Yes. Maybe that's too controversial. You know, I don't know, for a London-based community, which is very large, which, you know, all the parties are relying on when we go to the voting booths. You know, I just don't know if that makes a difference.
Well, they didn't say an awful lot under this. That I had 2 points that they said. And one was that the local transformation fund in each region would be local, so it'd be based in each region, which is obviously a good thing. And the people deciding on it would be people from the local chambers of commerce, trade unions, councillors. Those people would set the priorities for lending. And the other thing was that the National Transformation Unit, a key part of the Treasury, would not be in London. It would be based in the north of England somewhere.
Yeah. The Conservatives, of course, have done something similar in relation to the House of Lords. They said,
we could put
the House of Lords in the north
of England. House of Lords, that pain in the neck. They can go up north somewhere so that they won't really be able to influence decisions.
Yes, we'll put all the elements of government that we don't like up somewhere.
Where we can ignore them.
And we call it levelling up.
Yeah. Yes. And for me, that does seem like a... Because then they're out the way. They can't discuss things with us easily with MPs. They can't, you know, wiser heads can't discuss with the younger hothead MPs.
Yeah, but we do have to attend to decentralizing governance.
Absolutely.
You know, whether you put, you know, in a two house system, if you put one house somewhere completely else, you know, I'm not saying that that's a good idea. But, you know, again, you do need to devolve power a bit, and the devolved power has to be decentralized in order to have an effective governance system in place. And of course, what we've seen in this COVID crisis is that we have centralized our governance structure so much that we can't react quickly to an emergency situation. You know, we constantly are failing because the government is still holding on to power and thinks that they have to make all the decisions rather than releasing power. The regions have the data and can make the decisions very quickly according to the situation that is on their front doorstep. So then the next section in this section is energy.
Yep.
And they have promised to build 7,000 new offshore wind turbines, 2,000 new onshore wind turbines.
I think they were planning on turbines for offshore turbines.
You know,
those are material hats worn by people of an Eastern origin.
Turbines?
Turbines, yeah.
Right, okay.
Sorry.
I'm glad I'm not writing the policy. We might end up all with funny hats. No.
Only if you were doing it from a voice recognition software that did the writing for you.
22,000 solar panels gosh.
22,000 football pitches of solar panels.
Yes, exactly.
Because they like putting things...
They like the notion of football pitches, do they?
I think it's the idea is to put it across on a level that people can understand. But I can't understand how much space is taken up by 22,000 football pitches. Mm. And in fact, I checked on that. And the difference between minimum and maximum is somewhere between 89 million square meters and 237 million square meters. So it's a factor of 3 difference.
What do you mean, maximum and minimum?
Well, the minimum regulation size of a football pitch is, as those people who like watching football will know, it's minimum 90 meters by 45 meters for a football
pitch.
So
they're not all the same.
They're not all the same. And a maximum size is 120 meters long by 90 meters wide, which is, you know, area-wise, is 3 times the size.
I see it's where most of our listeners who also watch football...
Well, all the footballers are going, yeah, absolutely, we know that. So I thought I needed to be on with the footballers. That means that they would have an extra 53 gigawatts of offshore wind. They would have, I've not noted down how many watts of onshore wind, but they said there would be 2,000 new onshore turbines. The 22,000 football pitches of solar power. They would also have new nuclear power stations to replace the ones which are going offline in the 2020s.
Right, so they are pro-nuclear power.
Yeah, their feeling is not to inflate nuclear power or profligate or make us have more. Well, yes, it's more nuclear power. It is more nuclear power because it's continuing nuclear power. But they're saying, well, it's not more because it's just replacing one that goes offline with another one coming online.
There's a debate out there because nuclear power is carbon neutral, but it's not, as we said before, because also the manufacturing of or building of the nuclear power stations
involves quite a lot of carbon.
Yeah,
and the mining of uranium,
But for me, much more is the risk of, we're going into a world where we have more hurricanes, more storms, more flooding, more, unforeseen weather events of a crisis scale. And we're building nuclear power stations where the risks are so high.
Mm-hmm.
It's just beyond me.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of nuclear power stations either myself.
Right. They do talk about tidal as well.
So in the manifesto, they say that they will trial tidal energy and then expand it. But if you're going to trial it, you have to wait and see whether it's working well or not before you expand it, which, the Green Party would do as well. The great thing about trial of tidal energy is that it's, when it's going to happen, that you're going to get it. And it's every day, whether the wind's blowing or not, whether it's sunny or not. Then they also say that they will upgrade almost all of the UK's 27 million homes to the highest energy efficiency standards, reducing the average household energy bill by £417 by 2030 and eliminating fuel poverty. And then also to have a zero carbon standard for new homes being built, which is...
Is that zero carbon home standard, is that the equivalent of a passive house standard?
Yes.
So because I think I like the term zero carbon home standard better than passive house standards. People don't know what a passive house standard is.
Well, passive house standard is a standard. Carbon. No, actually, it's not in itself. No. Well, it's zero emissions if you have electric heating and the electricity for the electric heating comes from renewables. Right. So the passive house is a very low energy standard. That means you don't need to have heating in every room. You just have a little heater. And you need heat for heating hot water or electricity for heating hot water and for cooking.
They do also mention that they will roll out technologies like heat pumps, solar hot water and hydrogen, and invest in district heat networks using waste heat. District heat networks, there are already quite a few projects ongoing. We've got one in front of our doorstep. Stoke-on-Trent is at the moment building in a district heat network.
Mm-hmm. I used to work for a charity in Scotland called Energy Action Scotland, and I remember them having a conference in the 90s and people coming over from Europe where they had district heating systems which were heating 25, 30,000 homes. And they said the brilliant thing about those was that it got cheaper. Every time new homes signed onto the district heating system, it got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to heat their homes. The charity was all about fuel poverty.
Yeah, I think the Stoke-on-Trent one is supposed to reduce the city's carbon footprint by 12,500 tons a year.
Wow, okay.
And this is the equivalent, 12,500 tons per year is the equivalent of 2,500 hot air balloons.
Right. Oh, super, that's really great, yeah.
Right, okay.
People are getting a bit too enthusiastic about their
equivalences, gosh.
Maybe.
Was there a choice? Was there a discussion
they were going,
about?
Oh, we could have got how many baboons could be inflated with that? Or how many this, that, the other?
Right, back to our document. So they also mentioned heat pumps, and what I found a shame when we initially moved in here, we actually considered ground source heat, but it was just too expensive, and everyone was guiding us. Don't do it because you're not going to get the benefits of that.
Yeah, the average cost of a ground source heat pump is around about £6,500-£7,000.
This was just 5 or 6 years ago when we had to make the decision, and it's so short sighted that we had a financial systems where it wasn't economically viable to make that work. So we didn't go for that. We just put solar panels on, but we didn't put ground source heat in. But if, even 5, 6 years ago, if all of the new house owners were guided towards crowdsourced heat, we would already be in a better situation in terms of our carbon footprint.
Yeah, probably, because people wouldn't be heating their homes with gas systems.
Yeah.
And for us, it was difficult at the time as well, because we've got a home from about 1880. We insulated some of the walls downstairs. That's the other thing. When you retrofit homes, you've got to insulate everywhere. Once you've insulated everywhere, then a heat pump is a great idea. But before you've insulated everywhere, if you were to try and heat the house up with heat pumps, you'd need several heat pumps, and you'd be using a lot of electricity to heat the house. So, and then it would be expensive, and then people would start moaning about it and saying how terrible it was. So you do need to insulate the whole home fully before you put in the heat pumps.
So on the top of your head, how does the 7,000 new offshore wind turbines and 2,000 new onshore wind turbines compare to the Green Party's Green No Deal?
I was trying to check on that. The 7,000 new offshore wind turbines, they said, was 53 gigawatts, to have a total of 53 gigawatts, and the Green Party's recommending 70 gigawatts. So that's in the same sort of ballpark as the Green Party. The 2,000 new onshore wind turbines, off the top of my head, and I didn't get a chance to check that one, I don't know what that is for the Green Party. I know that the Green Party is saying that as old wind turbines, because wind turbines on land are now coming up to the end of their lives, their operational lives. So we think we would build bigger, taller ones and more powerful ones and put those back on the same site, sort of thing. So I'm presuming that's of a similar sort of ilk to the Green Party's.
Okay.
The solar panels, I think the Green Party had suggested that we were going to put solar panels on 3.8 million homes.
So how many football pitches is that? If we're measuring in football pitches.
I don't know in terms of football pitches. But in terms of square meters, it was 15 million, whereas the Labour Party are saying six times as much as that for the minimum size of football pitch and, 18 times that for the maximum size of football pitch. So we're saying 3.8 million homes because a lot of homes don't have a roof space or it's not pointing in the right direction. So we've estimated the number of roofs that we could use, and that comes to a 3.8 million. They're also talking about, and the costs of that, I think I looked at the cost the cost that we've done, and that would cost, ours would cost £24 billion. So if theirs was six times bigger, then it would be six times that, which is about £140 billion, or going up to £225 billion. So that's a lot of money, but if they're doing it in big sort of solar farms, that would be slightly cheaper.
Right.
So instead of 225, it might be £110 billion, but the costing, they haven't really put in how much things would cost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We think one of the issues with their green industrial revolution is not the connected calculation as a whole, isn't it? I think...
Yeah, the aspiration is great.
Yeah.
But the costing of it doesn't seem to have been done.
And certainly the evidence base and the justification is brilliant, and of course it reaches much more because the membership of the Labour Party is much higher. So the Green Deal, the vision document is just a fabulous, rich document. But when it comes to understanding how we collectively get to net zero carbon emission by 2030, there's not this collected calculation of, okay, this is what we're going to put in and this will resolve the issue. Right. The next section is ownership. And that's, of course, a key one. Yeah. And, as expected and as welcomed certainly by myself, there is a lot of renationalization in there. One of the first things that they mention under ownership is that a new UK National Energy Agency will own and maintain the national grid infrastructure. 14 new regional energy agencies will replace the existing district network operators. And then the supply arms of the big six energy companies will be brought into public ownership. And of course, at the time, that had a lot of discussion on the media, that the plans were too aspirational. But again, and we're living now in a post-pandemic type of world. I think having more public ownership of crucial public services that we all need to have a right to access, whether that's water, food, energy, transport, does make sense, in a world where we have to shift the economy into a much more sustainable one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't talk about how they would transfer that ownership. That's the only trouble.
So the next section is industry and innovation.
Yep.
And some things that I picked out, they will build 3 new steel recycling plants and upgrading existing production sites. I don't know very much about the steel sector. One could assume there's a sort of need to do steel in a much more environmental, sustainable manner. And there are ways how to do it. And I assume that's also where the steel recycling plants come in. Is that right?
Absolutely. So steel is like concrete. The production of steel from iron ore and stuff emits carbon dioxide. I think Germany in particular is working on producing steel in a less carbon intensive way, more electrically. And I think they've got quite some success with doing that. So that hopefully is a way to go in the future. But right now, and it makes a huge amount of sense anyway, if you recycle steel, the carbon dioxide losses have already happened. You know, it's a chemical reaction type of loss. So if you use recycled steel, you've done that already, and you're just reformulating the steel into something new. And of course, we should be recycling that. So
we seem to have a steel reprocessor in the UK, Tata Steel.
Tata Steel, yeah. So steel recycling would be a great thing to do, we think, or more steel recycling. Absolutely essential. We've got to do that. So it has to happen. And same thing with the plastic recycling industry. That has to happen. We should be doing that already. We should have been doing that 20 years ago.
One of the other things that they mentioned under industry and innovation is the UK, the automotive sector.
Yeah, where they talk about 3 gigafactories, which is kind of a weird thing to call them gigafactories. 3 big factories for electric vehicles.
Right. And just the last header in this section is skills.
Oh, just before that, they said also that they would target to have 3% of GDP spent on research and development.
Right.
And they mentioned crowding in private investment. I don't understand what that means.
I think there's a fundamental, you know, and I'm not an economist, so I'm not an expert in these areas, but I can't help and feel that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of how society and economy interacts with each other, so that you have much more angel investment, so the rich people reinvesting substantial amounts of money in innovation and new industries. You have that in societies where there is wealth pool to the top, where they can invest that sort of money.
America, basically.
Exactly. So whereas when you have economies where you have much more wealth distribution, like in general in Europe, you know, even taking the UK out of that equation, you don't have those ultra-rich people or the critical mass of ultra-rich people who then reinvest back. You know, there's much more a role for the state for innovation-funded investment, and there's much more space for cooperation, you know, where, as you said, where more people have ownership and stake in a venture.
Mm.
So I think, you know, there is this fundamental shift. And we came across that as well when we talked about Ursula von der Leyen's, you know, kind of digital economy in Europe. And we had this notion of we want the next big company to appear, the next big Google. And you kind of think, well, actually, the next big Google can only appear in societies or sectors. In an unfair society. Whereas when it's fair, you have much smaller companies, which are in generally much more, I would suggest, or less exploitative because they don't have a monopolistic opportunity to get ahead.
Yeah. And by when they're less exploitative, then the returns aren't going to be as high as well. So
yeah.
We have to take that on the chin along with all the other things that you've got to take on the chin. It's just a sort of reality of life.
Well, and when we talked about the, you know, the European vision for the next 5 years, you know, we said we don't want the big Googles.
Mm.
We want maybe, you know, 10 mini Googles, you know, that's okay. I seem to remember a time, you know, this must have been 10, 15 years back, where Google hadn't quite appeared as, you know, dominantly as it has. Where, you know, I had the choice of 7 different search engines. And even I had a search engine, which was called Meta 7 or something like that, which took the biggest results, which took the results from the biggest 7 search engines and put it together in one search engine result, which was fabulous. That was my go-to search engine. But, you know, Google overtook everything, you know, and 10 years later, 90% of the world searches with Google, except us. We don't search with Google.
Yeah, Ecosia. Ecosia.
DuckDuckGo.
They plant trees at Ecosia.
Well, Ecosia apparently is easier to
say. They offset carbon.
Ecosia is easier to say than DuckDuckGo, but... So the next section is skills.
Yep.
And that's where, of course, the big thing of about climate apprenticeships is in.
Yeah, big, and but it's not, again, it's not that planned out, I don't think. So they say that there'll be, because of the increase in skills, there'll be 1 million plus well-paid unionized jobs. And then they're going to train people to access these jobs, which actually has to happen before the jobs appear in a way. And they're going to make it easier for employers to spend the apprenticeship levy by widening the accredited training, apparently, which in lines with what's been recommended.
And in terms of numbers, they say more than 870,000 apprenticeships and more than 1 million new jobs. And I think the climate apprenticeships are great. And there is some thought about how the levy, the sort of apprenticeship levy, can be used for that. So there's a sort of more detail in relation to that. And of course, there are bursaries for targeted bursaries for BAME, for care leavers, ex-armed forces personnel, people with disabilities, to take up climate apprenticeships. So real incentive to get into climate jobs, which of course we know we need.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thing.
Right. And that's that section. And the next big section is transport.
Okay.
So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah,
I know we covered only one section of this long document,
which is economy and energy.
But the other ones, I think, are going to be a bit easier and a bit faster.
Yeah.
So come back next time to get the rest of the...
Yeah, or just click next episode if you're listening to this a bit later.
Yeah. If you enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, because it really helps for others to find us.
And we're also on Twitter, on Dithering on the Edge, at Dithering E.
Goodbye for now.
And goodbye for now.
And have a fabulous week.
Bye.
Bye.